Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, or anytime by visiting PRN.FM, click Archives, and scroll to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Or you can call in on our private listener line at 701-719-0884. Or go to your favorite app store and download the Progressive Radio Network app. Listen live or to the archive.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. On location today, we're going to be sharing the latest on vitamin D, anthocyanins, stress, and what it does to change our genes. Sacrificing, which can cause us to lose academic grades, and herbal teas to fight breast cancer, and so much more on health and healing. All of the information presented in this program comes from peer-reviewed journals, health, and we all know the different publications and the different centers. And the reason I do this is because we have an awful lot of professional people in the healthcare industry listening. They want to be confident they're going to pass this information on and apply it in their own practices that is grounded in good science. So it is. Also today, we're going to hear from Glenn Greenwald, a really high-quality journalist. He's a constitutional lawyer with The Intercept, and he's going to talk about how journalists eagerly manipulated on the Russian story. And then we're going to have another professor. A professor is probably one of the most knowledgeable professors, Stephen Cohen. I've had him on this program several times, talking about Russia in a different way. And then I'm going to continue with our segment on trying to encourage millennials to understand how not to be propagandized by the educational system, especially the Ivy League schools, the schools that we consider where our best and brightest students go. They become the leaders of the future. But it's not true. And it's not me saying it's not true. It's one of the leading academics from Stanford. So you're going to hear him give a five-minute talk to graduate students from Stanford, at Stanford, about you've become excellent sheep. And this is Professor William Dershowitz. So, and then in the effort to help our beloved station, sister station WBAI, where I've been on the air for 41, going almost 42 years, stay afloat and hopefully revitalize itself, and which I'm very encouraged that it will. I've done a retreat, and I want to give you just a small example of what happened at the end of the week to just three random women, and they'll be on in a little bit as well. I will be taking calls. I've asked my executive producer to hold off any more guests, except tomorrow night's Progressive Commentary Hour, so that I can spend more time with commentaries and talk back. And I'm going to be asking you about halfway through the show, with all the information I've shared, to give your input on these very important issues, these social issues. So let's say if you write down the number now, you'll have it so that when you come up with an idea that you believe is worth the audience listening to, by all means, give us a call at 888-874-4888. And also, I wanted to educate people more on the nature of poverty. And I did a documentary on this, and it took 7 years to actually complete this documentary. I had to travel all over the world, and it was called Poverty Inc. And I premiered it as a webinar 2 weeks ago, Sunday. No, a week ago, Sunday. And as of this morning, my IT person told me that we have 65,000 people who have watched it. So that's good. That's encouraging, because this summer I intend to take a little, I don't know how many, maybe 5, 10, on a little caravan to do two documentaries simultaneously, The Nature of Addiction and Everywhere That It Is, and also Poverty, The New Face of Poverty. We'll be filming in a lot of different locations and around the United States. So people are interested, and we're looking for solutions. And a lot of what I'm going to film are people who have good ideas how to deal with it. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. There is an herbal tea, according to the Times of India, with research done at Aston University and Russell Hall Hospital, showed that this tea could impact breast cancer in a very positive way. And they were able to arrest the growth of cells within 5 hours of application and cause the cells to die within 24 hours. Now, the plant, which has the botanical name, write this down, Phagonia, F-A-G-O-N-I-A, and the second word is Critia, C-R-E-T-I-C-A. And it's found in very arid desert regions of Pakistan and India and Africa and parts of Europe. And the professor, Helen Griffiths, who worked on this, found the herbal tea destroys cancer cells, but unlike conventional chemotherapy, does not damage normal breast tissue, and therefore you do not have the side effect. And the reports from breast cancer sufferers in Pakistan suggest that the plant extract doesn't trigger any side effects, like no loss of hair, drop in blood count, or diarrhea. And so that's something that's important. But it did impair the DNA response to cancer, so cancer could not flourish. And that is important. This research was done at a hospital just north of Lahore in Pakistan. Quote, it appears to keep the cancer cells in remission, although I won't use the word cure at this stage. However, they live for a long time without losing their hair or putting on large amounts of weight or experiencing other toxic side effects associated with chemotherapy. So we are confident this extract has something to contribute, end quote. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE. Now, you will not be able to find this today, but I always want you to have an idea of what's in the pipeline coming. And because it's not a drug, and because it's not in any of the pharmaceutical family, it can be sold as an herbal supplement. So I'm quite sure that within the next couple of months, it'll start appearing around the country. So at least you know there's something to help fight breast cancer that you otherwise wouldn't have known about, that's inexpensive and all natural. According to the Society for Research and Child Development, published in the peer journal Child Development, University of California at Los Angeles did some studies about sacrificing sleep, mainly college students, so they could study at night. And regardless of how much a high school student generally studies each day. If that student sacrifices sleep or a college student in order to study more than usual, they're more likely to have academic problems the following day. Because students tend to increasingly sacrifice sleep time for study in the latter years of high school, this negative dynamic becomes more and more prevalent over time. Those are the findings in this longitudinal study that focus on daily and yearly variations of students who sacrifice sleep study. Quote, sacrificing sleep for extra study time is counterproductive. Academic success may depend upon finding strategies to avoid having to give up sleep to study, such as maintaining a consistent study schedule across days and using school time as efficiently as possible, and sacrificing time spent on other less essential activities. So that's what they found. So, what's the takeaway message? Because it's not just for students that I would say this is important. Yesterday I did a lecture. It was a long lecture. It was about 3 hours. It was all based upon one single question about how responsible should my generation and our children, the X generation, be for the problems besetting the millennial generation. It was a legitimate question, and I answered it, but in a historical context, what our great-great-grandparents went through, and in a country that was a real challenge for them, and I brought it right up to date. In any case, one of the people, the person who did, is a student, never having time for anything because, you know, how much they're studying. So then I broke it down and I asked this person, when you're in a classroom, what are you thinking? Well, are you looking at what the student, the teacher is saying, and are you addressing the issues? And the person says, well, not all the time. Would it be fair to say that the classrooms you find interesting and the teachers that you like, you're more attentive to? But if you're in a class that you may find boring or a teacher that you're not particularly excited by, that you tend to think of other things or you may look at your cell phone or daydream? Yeah, that's correct. Well, what percentage of your classes do you really like and are excited to get in that class because you're going to learn something new and you like the way it's presented? Maybe 5 to 10%. So about 95% of your time is spent with your mind somewhere else. Yes. Okay. So you're not paying attention in class, and that means at some point you're going to have to study to make up for what you didn't pay attention to. And a textbook can never give you the full context that a teacher can. Because teachers like to make something less dry than a textbook, more interesting, and more relevant to people who are sitting in front of them. So, you make that up at night. Yeah. Now, when at night, you have other things you do before. Is there a time you set aside for social communication? Oh, yeah. And when does that start? It never ends. You mean your social connections and texting and Twittering are all day? All day and up until at night. So when do you actually study? Well, when I kind of am finished with all that, then I study. How do you study? Well, I have to, you know, drink one or two or three cups of coffee to keep me awake enough so I can study. So then instead of going to bed at a decent time to get a good night's sleep, you're staying up and then stimulating the brain with caffeine and overstimulating the entire immune system and overstimulating your pancreas and your adrenal glands and your thyroid gland. I don't know about that. Then when you wake up in the morning, you're not rested. Nope. So then you have to take additional caffeine to get your body moving, which means you're wired all day long. And when you're wired, you're not patient. You're not comfortable. You're not in a good mind to receive information and input. And this is the way it is. I remember when I was in college, my first college I went to, it was a business college because I wanted to graduate with a degree in business, which I did, so that no matter what else I was doing creatively, I would have an ability to create some kind of business that would allow me to survive and subsidize my creative time. And it worked. But I learned a lesson. I paid 100% attention in class. If there was something I was not sure of or something that didn't make sense, I asked a question. I just interrupted the professor and said, I have a question about this. And as a result, I never once in my entire college career did homework. Not once. At nighttime, I'd play basketball. Every night. And why? Because I got to understand that professors test you on what they teach you. And the textbook is really as a backup. And then I would always do additional study so I could expand upon what the teacher said because I was interested. What if the teacher only gave me part of the story? Where's the other story? What more can I learn? And so that's how I was able to get through the first college I went to, and it worked. It's just it's very rare today for students to go into a class with no cell phone, nothing to distract them, pay 100% attention to what's being taught, ask appropriate questions until they really understand what is being said. Then they're memorizing that. They're putting it into context. They're visualizing that information and projecting how they would use that information. And the test is relatively easy then. There's no reason for people to be doing it otherwise. Just a thought to help the millennials and others. We know that stress is dangerous. We know that those who are under stress are more likely to have a heart attack or stroke. We know that stressful people live shorter lives. You can take as much as 10 to 15 years off your lifespan if you're chronically stressed. Acute stress, which is severe, you can actually die from. From the peer-reviewed journal Translational Psychiatry comes a study. This is a brand new study that acute psychological stress, which is known to increase the risk of physical mental illness, is also altering the control of genes. And this report, which I believe is the first to show that stress alters the methylation of DNA and thus the activity of certain genes, it was just published. And it was done at a at the Ruhr University and in Switzerland. One of the most important discoveries in genetics is epigenetics. I talk about it all the time on this program, or what's called the second code. And the second code regulates gene activity. So now a lot of research is beginning to show that epigenetics, meaning the environment you're in, epi is the larger. If you're in any environment, it's going to impact your genes, either positively or negatively. And that can also lead to depression. It can lead to cancer. It can lead to heart disease because the stress in an environment changes the gene expression, and that's bad. And while the genome or the genetic code of or DNA for making a human being is more or less fixed once the sperm fertilizes the egg, it is the epigenome that decides how the blueprint is interpreted. So, how can I put this? Think of the genome as being the construction manual for making all the proteins the body needs, and the epigenome as the construction or maintenance guy reading the manual. Now, sometimes he'll have off days when he is tired and makes mistakes or just interprets the instructions differently. So cells function by making proteins. And which proteins they produce depends upon the cell's type, which is set in and by genes, and the environment, which influences how the genome reads the genes. And one way this happens is via the methyl groups, what are called the CH3 groups, that attach to sections of DNA, and these can remain in place for quite a while, even after the cell divides. So previous studies have shown that psychological trauma, abuse or loss early in life, are highly stressful events that are associated with long-term methylation changes. So you literally program your genes when you have any type of trauma or deep emotional pain, like a divorce of a parent or the death of a friend or a dog or a family member. That impacts directly the genes, and that carries through the rest of your life. So one more reason why we should be very conscious of the stressful positions we've been in life, and what I call living your life in reverse, meaning you start now and look at the most important or major occurrences in your life, and then you simply, like a emotional forensic expert, you break down the pieces. What happened? Who was involved? What did each person do? What did I do? Why did I do it? Why did I do something wrong when I could have done something right? How did it impact me afterwards? How did it impact others? What did I gain? All these questions we should be asking ourselves, and we're not. And then you suddenly say, wow, now I've looked at something. I had a bad relationship, and why did I stay in it? And you understand why you stayed in a bad relationship and you allowed someone to verbally or physically abuse you. Then you can say, now I got the message of that. And then you just keep going back and back and back. And that's living your life in reverse. And then at a certain time, you'll see that all these things that have happened to you, these remarkable or exceptional experiences, some positive, some negative, they're patterns of behavior, which means that you were so conditioned that you couldn't change. Now, with regressive hypnosis, you can go back and disconnect from that early trauma. And you can reprogram your DNA. So there's a very positive solution to people who've suffered. And that's important. A new study reported in Medical News, done at Massachusetts General Hospital and published in the peer-reviewed journal Pediatrics, about vitamin D. Why is it important? Because if you have children, this study shows that you can lower the risk of respiratory problems in kids with vitamin D. Now, you think that kids are outside, they're getting plenty of it, but they're not. Kids are not spending enough time outside, they're not spending enough time in direct sunlight, and they're not taking supplements of vitamin D. So make sure your children are getting their vitamin D, and they can end up with less respiratory problems. From a study on C-reactive protein, which is a bad thing, it's an inflammatory protein, and when it's elevated, you have a higher risk of vascular cell adhesion and death by heart attack or stroke. According to the University of Shogun and published in Nutrition, Metabolism, and Cardiovascular Disease, the antho is A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S, they can slash inflammation of C-reactive protein. Quite simply, by having your fruits, grapes would be number one, but blueberries right beside it, and pomegranate and cherries, you can cut your risk of inflammation that can lead to heart attack in half. In fact, just 24 weeks of consuming just a tiny amount, 320 milligrams, my goodness, that's a speck. That's like an eighth of a teaspoon. It's a tiny amount. Was still shown to be associated with reductions in inflammatory compounds. Quote, this is the first report that long-term supplementation with purified anthocyanidins can inhibit the inflammatory response in hypercholesterolemia subjects, end quote. Well, what this means is if you're on a plant-based diet, if you're eating lots of fruit, you're going to have less inflammation and an opportunity for having heart attacks or strokes. And the number one were grapes. You bet every morning or every day I get grapes in my system. You should too. You can eat grapes. That's terrific. And we can't always get organic grapes. That's just a reality because they're not available once a year. But you can buy grapes, and then you can do a couple things. You can put a veggie wash on them. There are 10 or 15 different varieties of veggie wash. And you spray it, and then you massage it over. And if it's lettuce, you make sure that you kind of massage the lettuce like you'd massage your head. You get in there with your fingers and get underneath little curves and curls in the leaf. And then you agitate it in water. And then you rinse it. And you do that three times. By washing something that way three times, you really get all the little tiny specks of dirt, which is good for growing, but it contains salmonella, can contain listeria, contain different pathogens in the soil itself, and that way it doesn't get in your body. And that's especially true to triple wash after spraying with a veggie clean. Triple wash that and rinse. Rinse, agitate, wash. Not do that in any restaurant. I've even seen restaurants where they'll take lettuce right out of a case and cut it up and put it in a bowl. My goodness, where are all the dirty hands? 24 separate hands, all dirty, are touching your food before you wash it or eat it in a restaurant. That's why I never, ever, ever eat anything that's raw in a restaurant, because I know, in restaurants, I know what goes on, and I have very high standards. But get your grapes. You can eat them. That's good. You can buy a bottle of Conker grape juice. That's your best grape juice, and that's good. And frequently you can buy it organic. And then you can take grape concentrate. That's even better because it's taken the water out up to a third of the water, so you're getting more of the anthocyanins in the concentrate, like a teaspoon. Or the most powerful of all would be to take some grapes that have been dehydrated as a powder, because you get the most. When you dehydrate everything, remember, 97 to 98% of all juices that you eat are water. So when you eliminate and wick off the water, you're left with the 2 to 3% of solid matter, and that is the payday. That's the mother load. That's the healing power is in what is left after the juice. But when you're drinking a glass of juice, you're also hydrating, which is good. That extra water you're getting is really good. It's generally like if you were to drink watermelon juice or celery juice. These are very purifying juices. They're great for your liver and your kidneys and your bloodstream, and they thin the blood, and they separate out the red blood cells from clumping and aggregating. So I highly recommend 6 glasses of fresh juice a day. It'll make a difference. Now I'm going to play you. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, you're going to hear 3 women. They come from different places in America. One's from Tennessee. They're all women of color. They all were very sick. And by the way, before someone comes to retreat, I don't speak with anyone. In fact, at the retreat, I never ask anyone. I'm not there to treat or diagnose anything. I'm there to help encourage wellness with my own insights and my own unique energy approach. But that doesn't mean there are not some great results. When we come back, you're going to hear some results. So A, we are able to now pay for about 1,000, I'm guessing about 1,000 to 1,300 premiums that you ordered with the money from the retreat. So it served its purpose. It helped the station. But when we come back, we're going to hear how it helped just 3 people. Back in a moment.
Hi, my name is Anna. I came to the retreat with a diagnosis of diabetes for the last 5 years. My blood sugar at the beginning of the retreat I took in the morning, it was 245. And after 7 days, my blood sugar dropped to 197. And that's quite a big drop, and I'm thrilled, and I feel fantastic. Also, I went into the gym, and I was doing weight lifting on my pecs, and I was able to lift 70 pounds, which prior to doing some, you know, some energy work with Gary, I was not able to do at all. With his energy work and his motivation, I was able to do 20 reps in a row. And I know I would not have been able to do that otherwise. It has been a wonderful retreat.
My name is Alexandra. I was diagnosed with MS in August this past year, and I came to Gary's retreat with extreme fatigue and pain in my back. I wasn't able to even walk one subway block without getting completely exhausted. Sorry, one block to the subway without getting completely exhausted. This week has been an extraordinary improvement. I now am able to walk 9 miles. So yesterday I completed the 9 mile mark, which is really exciting and I never thought was possible. Also, Gary had been doing some energy work with me. The first day I was in the gym with him and I was doing sit-ups, and I was only able to barely get through 3 minutes of sit-ups, and I was completely exhausted. And Gary then did some energy work with me, and I was able to do 10 minutes of straight sit-ups with no pause, no break, and I could have kept going. And someone counted, it was over 180 sit-ups. I also was able to do, I was on the pec machine, and Gary put about 50 pounds of weights on the weight machine, and I wasn't able to move the weight 1 centimeter. Then Gary did some energy work on me, and I was able to move the 50-pound weight 50 times. And I've learned that I can do anything, and anything is possible, and I'm excited to keep seeing the improvement. It's been incredible.
Hi, I'm Michelle, and when I came to Gary's retreat, the reason why I came here was to control my blood sugar. I knew that if my blood sugar remained out of control, that my diabetes would lead to more serious conditions later on in life. When I arrived here last Sunday, my blood sugar was 187. This morning, when I measured it, it was 80. I was expecting my blood sugar to lower some, but not to be completely normal. Gary's protocol is amazing, and I would recommend anybody buy his book and follow his protocol because it does work.
Okay, those are just three of the people. Every single person had something else happen to them that they're taking home to continue their journey of health and healing. There was a little static on the line because we're way out in the country. But let me just summarize. A woman who was living with diabetes and on medications which were not helping, her resting blood sugar, fasting blood sugar in the morning was 187. That's very high. After just 1 week with no medication, her blood sugar is normal at 80. She's also lost 20 pounds. That's just one person. She was hoping it would drop 3 or 4 or 5 points. It dropped 108 points. The woman with multiple sclerosis had been in the hospital, she told us, for 2 weeks before coming, where she couldn't move her legs. She had pain up and down her back and sharp shooting pains going down out of her hips. And she had this also. And the doctors told her that nothing could be done to reverse her condition, that she would simply have to adapt to it getting worse until finally it took her life. And she's only 24 years of age. And she was deeply concerned and saddened by this. And when she would go out, and she would go just one block to the subway, The rest of the afternoon, she would have to sleep 6 hours after that because she was in such fatigue. And she was on crutches as well. So I work with her. And she now has learned a whole lot about energy and the power of the body to change. And I took her in the gym. In fact, two of them were in the gym. Everyone was in the gym at the same time. And so I asked her to lift some weights on what you might call, it's a butterfly beam, where your arms are under weights and you bring them together towards the middle of your chest. And she couldn't. And so it was at 50 pounds, and I said, try your best. And she couldn't budge them. And then about 30 seconds later, she was not only able to budge them, but she was whipping them out so fast she did 50. And I stopped her. She could have done 100. And she's very slight. She doesn't weigh 100 pounds. And yet she was lifting half of her weight with her arms, these little thin arms, 50-pound weights. And that got everyone's attention. And then the other woman wanted to try it, and she couldn't lift 6 pounds. And then she lifted 20 times, just boom, 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 like it was nothing, like it was a straw. And everybody was wondering, heck, this happened. I was going around and working with other people doing different things. And I won't go into it now. I simply said that there's two ways that we can change. We can change incrementally, little tiny steps at a time, but that rarely does that get us where we want to go. Or we can do a quantitative change where we change instantly by surrendering the limitations of our conditioning, in which case we go from not being able to do something to being able to exceed at doing it. And the reason I do these little things is to encourage other people, like Bannister, who broke the four-minute mile. The whole world said you can't break the four-minute mile, and he did it, and then within 2 weeks, a whole lot of other people did it. So if you have someone who went out who couldn't walk a block, couldn't walk 100 feet without being completely debilitated and exhausted, and yet she walked 9 miles fast. She was up with the walkers without stopping, with no water. And then it was like she had just was jumping up on a trampoline up and down because she was so excited. And she said, I have no pain. I have no fatigue. I feel phenomenal. And all the other participants were watching this. And I said, there's a move that positive energy can manifest in different ways. It's far more complex than what I'm explaining. I'm just trying to give you the simple explanation. But not only has the station got an infusion, but a lot of guests are also going home or have gone home today with a whole new lease on life. And that's important. Now we're going to go over, and I'm going to play you 3 back-to-back short audio clips. And then I'm going to open it up for your comments, input on them. The key when calling in is always ask yourself, say something will encourage, inspire, or empower people by my thoughts, questions, or challenges. And that's what makes radio even better, by we being inspired by what we hear and the voices of other people. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. This is the outstanding journalist, Glenn Greenwald, talking about how easy it is for people from the New York Times and CNN and all the mainstream media to be manipulated. They're not dumb. They're very bright people. They're very well-educated people. Most come from very good schools and backgrounds. So why is it that this audience and the people we have on know the truth, about false flags. No, it was not Assad killing his own people. Absolutely no reason for him. Trump said he was pulling out. Russia had won, had defeated ISIS, not America. It was Russia. And they were starting to rebuild Syria. The Syrian people love Assad, and he's done right by them. We've tried to demonize him as we did Gaddafi, and wrongly so. So why is it that we know the White Helmets are a terrorist organization, but Democracy Now! Promotes them? Why is it we know the truth of false flags, that the United States is the number one purveyor of terrorism in the world, but these journalists can't find that? But some journalists like Chris Hedges have found it, and a lot of others have found it. And why are the journalists who found the lies not allowed on the stations where the other journalists haven't? It's becoming so abundantly clear. Here's Glenn Greenwald providing his insights. Please listen.
Counting since the 2016 election, the hunt is still on for proof of Russian meddling. Did Putin get Trump elected? We still don't know. We did recently speak, though, to progressive journalist Glenn Greenwald, who said the press is replacing good reporting with inaccurate scandal mongering. Watch this. So, Glenn, just to get to the facts of this story, it is conclusively shown that the story about the 21 voting systems being hacked is untrue, correct?
It's false in two ways. One is that several of the states included in the list, such as Wisconsin, California, and Texas, said that the websites that the Homeland Security Department cited have nothing to do with voting systems. They're entirely unrelated. And it's false in a second way, which is a lot of the stories, in fact, most of them, said that Russia tried to hack into the voting systems, when in fact, even Homeland Security, it can only show that what they did was scan those computer systems, which is basically casing something to see for vulnerabilities, and made no attempts to actually hack into them. So it was false on various levels.
So you and I don't agree on a lot of issues, but I think we share the same concern about this story, and that is that American journalists are being manipulated for whatever reason by the intelligence community in the United States. And I'm wondering why, after years of having this happen to American journalists, they're allowing this to happen again.
Well, that's the thing. I would reframe that a little bit. I don't actually think so much that journalists are the victims in the sense of that formulation, that they're being manipulated. I think, at best, what you can say for them is they're willingly and eagerly being manipulated. because what you see is, over and over, they publish really inflammatory stories that turn out to be totally false. And what happens in those cases? Nothing. They get enormous benefits when they publish recklessly. They get applause on social media from their peers. They get zillions of retweets. Tweets, huge amounts of traffic. They end up on TV. They get applauded across the spectrum because people are so giddy and eager to hear more about this Russia and Trump story. And when their stories get completely debunked, it just kind of everybody agrees to ignore it, and everyone moves on, and they pay no price. At the same time, they're feeding and pleasing their sources by publishing these stories that their sources want them to publish. And so there's huge amounts of career benefits and reputational benefits and very little cost when they publish stories that end up being debunked, because the narrative they're serving is a popular one, at least within their peer circles.
Gosh, that's so dishonest. I mean, I think all of us in journalism have gotten things wrong. I certainly have. And you feel bad about it. I mean, you really do. And there's a consequence. You really think there's that level of dishonesty in the American press?
I think what it is more than dishonesty is a really warped incentive scheme bolstered by this very severe groupthink that social media is fostering in ways that we don't yet fully understand.
Yes.
Most journalists these days aren't in congressional committees or at zoning board meetings or using shoe leather reporting. They're sitting on Twitter talking to one another. And this produces this extreme groupthink where these orthodoxies arise, and deviating from them or questioning them or challenging, believe me, results in all kinds of recrimination and scorn. And embracing them produces this sort of in-group mentality where you're rewarded. And I think a lot of it is about that kind of behavior.
That is really deep. I mean, you live in a foreign country. I'm not on social media. So maybe we've got a little bit of distance from this. Where do you think this story is going? What's the next incarnation of it?
Well, the odd part about it and about the impatience that journalists have in trying to just jump to the finish line is that there are numerous investigations underway in the city, including by credible investigators, including Senator Burr and Warner and the Senate Intelligence Committee, which most people seem to trust, and certainly Robert Mueller, who's armed with subpoena power, and everyone is really eager to lavish with praise. So we're going to find out, presumably one way or the other, soon enough. I guess the one thing that's so odd to me, Tucker, is that this has been going on now for a year, this accusation that the Trump administration or the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians to hack the DNC and John Podesta's email. And we know that there are huge numbers of people inside the government who are willing to leak, even at the expense of committing crimes, in order to undermine Trump. And yet there's been no leak so far showing any evidence of that right. kind of collusion, leading one to wonder why that is. So I hope that everybody's willing to wait until the actual investigation reveals finally the real answers. But it doesn't seem that will be the case.
Bravery is when you disagree in public with your peers. And by that definition, you are a very brave man, Glenn Greenwald. Thanks for joining us tonight. I appreciate it.
Now, that's Tucker Carlson. And I find it remarkable that Tucker Carlson on Fox would be the only journalist in the media, mainstream media, who had the courage to bring on people to challenge many of their own colleagues. And I disagree with Tucker on several issues, but I believe he's a person of principle, and he does about 5 to 6 debates a night. That takes a lot of homework. It also takes a pretty smart person to do that. But he has been ahead of the curve and on the right side of history on a lot more issues than anyone on MSNBC, everyone on CNN, and the people I couldn't stand to watch on Fox. So good for him for being at the right place. Now let's hear from a short comment from Professor Stephen Cohen. He is probably America's, not even probably, he is America's leading authority on Russia. And he's been a scholar on the subject for 50 years, from Yale, New York University, many books. And he knows what he's talking about. Let's hear him give his insights on criminalizing better relations with Russia.
Year, the press has told us about how Russian collusion destroyed American democracy, but they've had a problem. Actual evidence of collusion does not exist, so instead reporters have been totally reliant upon leaks from within the federal bureaucracy and the intelligence community. Can these leaks be trusted at face value, or could there be other agendas at work? Stephen Cohen's been following this for a long time. He's professor emeritus of Russian studies at NYU. He's also a contributing editor at The Nation, and he joins us tonight. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Tucker.
So I'm reading The Washington Post today, which is the Jeff Bezos publication, and right on the front page there's a piece about Russia. And the subhead says here, hacking democracy, as if it is a known and universally accepted fact that our democracy was, quote, hacked. Do we know that?
We do not. It's been alleged. Originally, it was said that 17 intelligence agencies made that finding. Turned out it was a few people and a couple intelligence agencies. If you read on in the Washington Post story in the first paragraph, they go back to this claim that it's the consensus of the intelligence agencies. So it's simply not true. I have to say that in addition to being professor, for a long time, I was also a paid consultant of a major American television network. I admire mainstream media. I learned a lot, but I have never seen media malpractice like this before in my life. What that constitutes is essentially making allegations for which there is no verified fact, information, or evidence, and then basing your commentary on it. So, briefly put, it's said that somehow Trump has been compromised by Putin, the leader of Russia. Then when Trump does diplomacy with Putin, the New York Times literally calls it treason. I've never seen anything like this before.
So a lot of what we think we know about this story comes from the intelligence community or from the permanent parts of the U.S. government, yeah. career bureaucrats, yeah. some of whom are knowledgeable. But they're passing on information to reporters, and reporters appear to be reprinting it uncritically. Do you think that reporters should keep in mind that there are sometimes agendas attached to these leaks?
Well, you know what's odd? Well, you just made the valid point. A leaker, by definition, has a political agenda. We'd agreed on that, right?
Yes, of course.
You may not be old enough to remember, but I remember when the media, and particularly the liberal media, was deeply suspicious of intelligence agency sources.
Yes, I remember.
Now we have
well.
A situation where they seem to be the holy writ. If they whisper it to you on the telephone, it's true, and you print it. But they are as apt to make mistakes. I mean, the same Washington Post story today said something amazing. It said that President Trump has an aversion to this Russiagate intelligence. How nice it would have been if John F. Kennedy had had aversion to the intelligence that led to the Bay of Pigs. How nice it would have been if
That's
President
right.
Johnson had been, had an aversion to the intelligence that left us, led us ever deeper into Vietnam.
Well,
and nobody
exactly
need
right.
recall Bush's reliance on intelligence when we went to war in Iraq. A president who is skeptical about intelligence, critical-minded of it, is a good president.
Is a wise president, for certain. So just to circle around to my first question, make certain I have this absolutely right, do we have, that you have seen, any evidence at all that the Russian government materially affected the outcome of the 2016 election?
I have heard you say repeatedly there is no evidence. I've looked harder than you have. I've
yes.
looked here in America, but I also have looked in Moscow. I mean, when I'm there, I ask people I know, and yes, I confess, I do know people who are or have been Russian intelligence agents. I haven't found anybody in Moscow who believes this story.
And you are a Russian speaker, so that says a lot. I'm sure you'll be denounced as a tool of Putin for saying so, but we appreciate your analysis of that. Professor, thanks for coming on tonight.
Thanks, Tucker.
Okay, once again, it's Tucker Carlson who has the objective guest, who is not pro or con. He's simply using his deep scholarship, deeper than anyone else in America, to tell the truth. What we know up to this point is that before any official investigation from outside bodies was done on the cause of the gas attack, chlorine gas, because it wasn't sarin gas, they decided that they had enough proof, but they did not present this proof. And that raises all kinds of red flags. And this was not a legitimate response to a terrorist attack. This was a false flag. And like so many false flags in the past, they sell it to the American public, and they can only do that by controlling certain assets, which under oath and before Congress, the former head of the FBI and the Church Committee said that they had over 1,000 sources in the media that they controlled. Those are their assets. And then we forgot it. And decades go on, and they didn't stop giving money to those assets or influencing them. It only increased. Now, that was 35 to 40 years ago. How many more assets do they control? And we know that the Pentagon spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year in propaganda. We know that virtually every division of government, every one of these agencies has their own cyber attacks and trolls and all these other ways of influencing other sites. We know that right now more than 200 legitimate progressive websites like Truthdig and Consortium News and Global Research have been not just attacked and demonized, or like Robert Perry's site and Chris Hedges' site, but we also know they've worked with Facebook and Google to secretly manipulate the algorithms, so when these people write a story and send it out, it's not going out. And only the people who would know to go to the site ever read it. And I personally spoke with Robert Perry before he died. And I've spoken with others who run sites, because a lot of them appear on Progressive Radio Network. And they say that we're down 30, 40, 50% in our readership because we're not getting out. We're getting blocked. Now that has come out. Now it's a matter of fact. It's on the record. Oh, they try to backtrack it and apologize for it. And the most pathetic excuse for a congressional hearing on Mark Zuckerberg. And I'll get to that when I have time. But now it's out in the open. I told a group last night, I said, I look at it a little differently. I think that right now you should appreciate what Trump has been able to do in one respect, not in any of his policies, they're all absurd. But if Hillary Clinton had been elected illegitimately, as it turns out, as we know, then you would not know the deals she would be cutting with the arms manufacturers and Israel to attack Iran, destabilize Iran, destroy Iran and Syria, and put puppets in their place, all to the benefit of the military-industrial complex. You would not know the deals she would make to reinstitute, which she supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and not lessen jobs flowing out of America, but actually increase jobs flowing out of America. At the same time, she'd be telling unions that she supported them, which she has never supported unions. Oh, I'm just saying here, wow, we're out of time. I'm sorry I wasn't paying attention to the time. I'll look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.